Sue Perkins and welcome to Nature Table. The natural world is full of surprising facts. For example, did you know that sloths only defecate once a week, expelling a third of their body weight, leaving them drained and vulnerable to attack? Which is why I always keep a can of Red Bull and a flick knife at the bathroom at all times. Acorns are poisonous to humans, which makes me wonder, why are the squirrels hoarding them? And what are they planning? We're coming to you from the Huxley Theatre at ZSL London Zoo. The zoo appeared in the film An American Werewolf in London, where the protagonist wakes up in the wolf enclosure after a disturbing night. I'm still waiting for them to make a film about the time I woke up in Penguin Beach with a traffic cone and Michael Ball's phone number. With me to get close up to the best the natural world has to offer and say, oh, that looks a bit rude, is stand-up comedian Lucy Porter, and arriving laden with gifts like courtiers desperate to placate their temperamental new monarch, zoologist and wildlife presenter Yusuf Rafiq, and from the Invertebrate Conservation Trust Bug Life, its entomologist, Professor Karim Baed. Lucy, a glorious welcome back to Nature Table. Now, as an animal lover, I want to ask the serious questions. Mm-hmm. Would you rather have webbed feet or a lion's mane?
Oh, well, webbed feet is tempting because I love to swim, but then I do also enjoy wearing flip-flops. So that could be a problem.
Yes.
I am slightly obsessed with lions. The mane, I do love big hair, and I grew up in the sort of 80s hair metal era. I used to fancy David Coverdale from Whitesnake.
Oh, yes. I mean, he was 90% hair.
He was. He wasn't born, he was knitted, as they say.
Yes. Extraordinary.
I think lion's manes, they tried to work out why they have them, and they were like, oh, is it sort of for warmth? But it's like, no, it's Africa, mate. And they worked out it is purely to appeal to the chicks.
Yes.
Very much like David Coverdale.
Yusuf, welcome to the show. Now, you're a zoologist.
Yes. Was
this born out of interesting encounters with wildlife as a kid?
I do have, like, one weird memory as a child. I'm half Moroccan, so I spent a lot of holidays in Morocco, and we'll go to the beach, and obviously normal activities to do at the beach is build a sandcastle or have an ice cream. What I like to do, though, I like to chase around the dung beetles and, like, watch them roll their balls of poo. But it's fascinating.
I mean, it's a mini break, I guess. I mean,
yeah.
Well, luckily you can do that on British beaches, thanks to.
Karim, welcome back to the show. You're a leading professor of entomology and expert in crickets and bush crickets. I have to obviously then ask, would you rather have wings or antennae?
Well, I think I'd go for the antennae for the simple reason that if I were to support my own body weight with wings, I'd have to be about 6 to sort of 10 metres across in wingspan, and I think they'd rather get in the way. I think I'd go for the antennae because we think of antennae as feelers, but they do so much more. They're actually how the insects smell the world. For example, a male moth can detect a receptive female from over a kilometre away. So I think it'd be amazing to have that super sense.
Sounds like Love Island.
So you want to be able to detect females from further away?
No, perhaps not. That came out wrong, didn't it? I'd also like to have antennae.
Are you getting anything off me now? Is there anything?
Well, listen, let's get this party started. Yusuf, what's the first thing you've brought to lay on the sturdy old nature table of mine?
Well, I think the first thing's actually a picture. Yeah, there we go. So, do you know what that is?
I believe that is a grass snake.
It is, yeah, it is indeed. So it's one of three species of snake that we have here in Britain. The grass snake, the adder and the smooth snake. This is the biggest one. They can get almost up to 2 metres long, but they are non-venomous, so they're pretty much harmless.
Ooh, they're creepy, though.
No, they're not creepy. That's why I'm here to tell you how
they... I know.
They're not creepy. What I want to tell you about it today, though, is its defensive behaviour.
Okay.
So a lot of people think of snakes as aggressive. A lot of people think they're venomous. Some of them are. But most snakes are non-venomous. But these guys do something very special, and it's called thanatosis. When they're getting attacked by a predator or something, they will essentially play dead. The first thing they'll do is excrete this really strong musk from their anal glands. So essentially they're just farting their way out of trouble.
We've all done that of an evening.
But sometimes that's not enough to deter any predators because, you know, some birds might like that. So... but anyway, these guys can take it a step further. And what they'll do is they'll flip over onto their backs and they'll stick their tongue out their mouth. They'll have their mouths open. So they really do look dead. And it's actually a really effective method of evading predators because nobody wants to eat a dead, smelly thing.
It's what I do if my husband gets amorous.
Yeah.
What I want to know is, if a bird wants to attack a snake, It's obviously its objective is to kill the snake and then eat it. If the snake is playing dead, why doesn't the bird just carry on? Is it that the smell has now infected the entire length of the snake?
Yeah, it's just like a rotten smell. So it thinks it's a rotten corpse. And, you know, as evolution happens, in general, things don't want to eat dead things because they can pick up diseases.
The bird's not very bright, is it? Because it's just killed it, and yet its primal sense is saying this is an old carcass.
Yeah, so it's not a thing the bird is consciously doing.
Yeah.
It just knows not to eat it.
Well, isn't that what you're meant to do if you get attacked by a grizzly bear? Aren't you meant to, like, lie down and pretend to be dead and secrete from your anal gland? And,
I'd be doing more than that, let me tell you. I'd be secreting from every gland of a grizzly bear. What slightly confused me about this picture is this snake is swimming. I didn't know snakes had hobbies.
I mean, yeah, so...
I mean, if anyone's cold water swimming, they always bloody tell you about
it,
don't they?
Yeah.
They do.
Oh, yeah.
And then they try and co-opt you into it like it's fun.
I've noticed that as well. They do love the water, and that's because they actually hunt in the water. So unlike a lot of other snakes, one of these guys' favourite foods are amphibians, which obviously you find in the water. They're not amphibious themselves. They do need to come out of the water, but they can hold their breath for up to, you know, 20, 30 minutes at a time. So they're quite impressive swimmers.
How big is that one, then?
Well, this one in particular? I don't really know, because I can't see the end of it. That looks...
Also,
it would require a wider photo showing something we call perspective, which would enable us to make a better judgment call.
I mean, I didn't take this photo, so I don't know this individual, but it looks like an adult, so, you know, I'd guess maybe 150 centimetres.
That's my height.
Estimation, is it?
Oh. Yes.
But they're very cool animals.
And, you know, you talk about them playing dead. There's an element of the sort of the amdram, of the theatric about these snakes. Do they disguise themselves as other snakes? Can they appear more menacing, or can they change? Can they shapeshift in any way?
They can. So, yeah, I mean, so there's been some research into another behaviour they do where they basically mimic cobras. So they can kind of hood up. So a lot of snakes can actually have that hood. It's not just a cobra thing. But nobody really knows why this is, because they're not cobras, they're not related to cobras. There's a few theories. So obviously the benefit of hooding up like that is to scare predators or any threats. They reckon it could be a sort of ancestor species of cobra that we used to have in this part of the world. So they could be mimicking that. Or they reckon it could be that the African migratory bird species that obviously spend their winter months out in Africa and come across cobras all the time, when they fly over here for the summer, these guys are mimicking cobras because they know somehow that those birds know not to mess with a cobra.
So, but they've never seen a cobra.
I know, it's mad.
That's so weird, isn't it?
Alternative theory, they have seen Liam Gallagher in his parka.
Yeah.
More likely.
I reckon that's the one, yeah.
Well, the grass snake is one, as you've said, of only three snakes found in the UK, the others being the adder and the smooth snake. As well as looking different, it's possible to tell the snakes apart from the sounds they make. For example, this is the grass snake. While an adder sounds more like this.
Darth Vader.
And finally, the smooth snake sounds like this. Yeah. Something for you to all watch out for there. Yusuf, thank you so much for bringing the wonderful grass snake.
Thank you.
Snake in the grass, you. Karim, you look like a man who can gift and gift fulsomely. So gift us up. What have you brought for us?
I have the Australian redback spider, which is a type of black widow.
Let's have a look. I mean, this is an infamous beast.
And it's about the size of a garden spider, if you're familiar with female garden spiders about this time of year. It's black, and it has a little red hourglass mark underneath its abdomen. It's really an excuse to talk about sexual cannibalism.
Woo! I knew you wouldn't let me down. Okay, so I've learned over the course of making the show that spiders can fly and grow to be a foot wide. And now you're telling me that sexual cannibalism is a thing, so they're even more horrifying.
It's actually very widespread in spiders, and there have been studies of the Australian redback spider that have actually shown that the females do, in something like 60 to 80% of copulations, eat the male. Now, at one time, we thought that the females were basically taking advantage of the males. They were just getting a free meal. They might have mated already. They can store sperm, so they might just be eating males because, you know, they're hungry. And in the Australian redback spider, what we've learned is that the male is actually complicit in the act. There's a photograph on the screen of a female eating a tiny male. The male's much smaller than the female. Mm. But what the male actually does is he flips his body into the female's jaws to allow himself to get eaten during copulation.
Listen, we mustn't kink shame, so let's have no jokes about this, all right? I'm not in the business of that, for goodness sake. One world and all are welcome in it. What I want to know is, what's the evolutionary reason for that? What's the point?
That's a really interesting question. There's been an interesting series of studies on this. And what it's been found is, basically, the male is able to copulate for longer and transfer more sperm if he gets nibbled at than if he... if he doesn't get eaten. So for example, in one study, males that got eaten during copulation copulated for twice as long as males that didn't.
Hey, guys, listen, we've got some great news. We've worked out how you can last longer in the bedroom.
There is a downside.
Can I talk about spider sex in general?
Oh, I mean, I think this is the perfect forum for it.
I think it needs to be pointed out that spiders are quite unusual. The male doesn't transfer sperm with a penis. Instead, he uses his front limbs. They're a little pair of limbs either side of the mouth parts called the pedipalps. And the male has great big syringes on them, and he has to charge these syringes with his own sperm. So he ejaculates onto a web, as you do, and then he sucks up...
What do you mean, as you do?
He sucks up his own sperm into his syringe-like pedipalps, and it's these that he inserts into the female. Now, he's got two of these, so he's effectively got two penises, and it so happens the female's got two vaginas.
Oh, of course she has.
It's a match made in heaven, just like the kangaroo. I've forgotten what I was talking about now. Oh, yeah. So it turns out that by being eaten, not only can the male prolong the insertion of his pedipalps, but he can also have a greater chance of being able to insert not one, but two.
God, I don't know about you, I've never been more aroused.
Do any male spiders take a vow of chastity? Do they see this going and go, I'm aroused?
Every man in this audience has crossed his legs. Yeah.
There are actually some spider species where the males actively avoid being cannibalised.
And so, they're called clever spiders.
Because, after all, it's sort of a trade-off, isn't it? You know, fertilising a greater proportion of the eggs of one female versus going off and mating with lots of females. So some spiders try and take the other strategy, and they do all sorts of clever things to try and avoid sexual cannibalism. There's one species of spider where the male actually ties down the female with strands of silk so she can't cannibalise him.
50 shades of spider.
Redback spiders may eat their mates, but they're not always so greedy. In fact, they can survive without food for 100 days. 300 days was once recorded, although I believe that one was preparing for a film role. Which animals, however, can go even longer without food? Well, let's find out with a round of the biggest game show on Spanish TV, The Other Hunger Game. The Other Hunger Game. Name an animal, and you've got to tell me if it can go longer or shorter without food than the preceding animal. So, Karen, we're going to start with you. We know that the redback spider can go 100 days without resorting to Deliveroo. What about the scorpion? Does it last for a longer or shorter time without needing to eat?
I would say longer, because there's not a high prey density where they live, so they probably have to survive. Also, I had a pet one, and I neglected it a bit. I didn't feed it for ages, and it was still okay. I shouldn't really admit to that, should I? Bug life man. He was great. I fed him in the end. He was fine.
What happened to him?
Well, he did die eventually, of course, yeah. But I actually fed him too much water. I felt sorry for him, and it was a desert species, and I thought he was needing water. I gave him a big sponge of cotton wool, and he just carried on drinking and drinking and drinking until he like nearly burst. It was like a balloon.
Can I ask... You are an expert in... we brought you here as the definitive guide. So you think longer?
Yes.
You're absolutely right, yeah. The scorpion can go up to a year without eating. To maintain such a slow metabolism, scorpions can spend over 90% of their lives inactive, which is the opposite of me, because the longer I sit in front of Netflix, the more I eat. Yusuf, what about the great white shark? Can the great white shark go longer or shorter than the scorpion?
Grey white shark? That's a good question.
It's the only one you're getting, isn't it?
I know. Shorter.
You're absolutely right, yeah. The great white shark, 3 months maybe without eating. So that shark in Jaws 4 could technically have gone the whole summer without eating a member of the Brody family. Just being a dick. One for you now, Lucy. The Galapagos tortoise. The gentle giant. Does the Galapagos tortoise go longer or shorter than 3 months without eating?
Well, I had a pet tortoise. And it did go a long time without eating.
Has anybody actually fed a pet on this panel?
I'm going to say longer. I think it's going to be... because they get so old, I think they've got a very slow metabolism. Very much like myself. Tend to chunk up around the leg area.
Well, the Galapagos tortoise indeed can go without eating or drinking for up to a year, storing food and water to survive the long, dry season. To put that in context, the very hungry caterpillar can't even wait for you to turn the page. Just eat straight through. So that's the end of the game. Karen, thank you for bringing in this amazing spider. Timely, pleasure. As I just run out of things to have nightmares about. Now, it seems silly to come to the zoo and not chat to some of our wonderful staff here. So, well, if only in the vague hope they'll let me take a pygmy hippo home this time. Is Rob Deville here?
Yeah.
Now, forgive me if I pronounce this incorrectly. Cetacean Strandings Programme Manager.
That's right. So
what does that mean?
We investigate strandings of whales, dolphins and porpoises around the UK coast and try and find out how they've died.
What have you brought in for us?
It's actually a tooth from a species of whale called a Cuvier's beaked whale, which is the deepest diving whale on the planet. So it would go and then come up to the surface 3 hours and 20 minutes later. So really extreme diving animals, and they dive down to 3,000 metres or so. It's come from a male. So males have teeth that erupt at the front of the lower jaw. Females don't. And they have two teeth that stick out, and they use them for fighting because they're suction feeders. They find squid at depth, suck the prey in, so you find a male to be heavily scarred from these battles over females at depth.
The teeth don't need to be sharp because the predators need to be sucked rather than bitten.
Yes, using the teeth not for feeding, it's just for fighting. Males, right?
Oh, those guys.
The other cool thing to point out about that tooth is if you look at the tip of it, there are two little bumps on the surface. And that's where it would have had goose barnacles growing out of the tooth whilst it's alive. So if you picture this 5.5-metre-long whale holding its breath, diving down to 3,000 metres with kind of barnacles growing off the tip of its teeth at the front of the lower jaw, pretty cool.
Very much the Shane McGowan of the animal world.
Rob, an absolute pleasure having you. Round of applause, please, for Rob. Like the disciples at the Last Supper having rearranged the chairs for the fifth time and somehow all ended up on the same side again. Let's go back to the table. Yusuf, there's a corner of my table that's empty. Please fill it.
I've got some stick insects.
Oh.
So these ones I've got here are Diaphrodes gigantea, so giant green bean stick insect. So they're a species that shows sexual dimorphism, so the males and females look very different.
So I'll describe for our listeners. One is almost, or certainly a third bigger, and quite a nice sort of lime green colour, and the other is bonier, less full of figure, and a sort of dun-coloured,
which
suspecting is the male.
It is, yeah. How did you guess the male was the Borum one?
Well, I just thought...
That's a good guess.
Well, often it isn't that way in nature, but I just sort of thought that might be one of the reasons you'd brought it in.
These are gorgeous, aren't they?
They are, and another thing to look at are the wings. So the males, you can see, have got really long wings going the entire length of their body, whereas the females, because, you know, they don't really have to do much, they have tiny little green wings, so they can't fly.
They don't have to do much, by which you mean they just dazzle.
Yeah.
It's just like, look at
me. They just look good, so all the males fly in from everywhere and, you know, mate with them. But, so they used to be my pets. And so stick insects...
Don't tell me you didn't feed them either. What is this?
I did feed them.
There needs to be a sort of supplementary welfare programme run for panellists. In terms of evolution, is it an obvious question to ask why they look like sticks?
Yeah, it's kind of self-explanatory. It's a camouflage, but it's not just a physical camouflage. It's also behavioural, because the stick insects will move from side to side, so it looks like a stick swaying in the wind, which is really clever.
Really?
So that just adds an extra layer of that camouflage. And there's also a species in Australia that can move the abdomen and like curl it upwards to look like a scorpion. So that's another way of mimicking something, so another method of evading predators.
In terms of reproduction, it could almost create a fire if those two got together.
Yeah.
What do they do?
Well, they've got some weird sex habits.
Of course they have.
I mean, so depending on different species, they do different things. So you get sexual stick insects that you need a male and female for. The males have these special organs that basically clasp onto the females, and then they do their sex thing. And but interestingly, right, so there's a species of stick insect in India that has one of the longest copulations of any animal. Have a guess how long they have sex for.
A week.
79 days.
Exactly 79 days.
That's the longest recorded, yeah. Which is kind of annoying. You want to get to 80, wouldn't you?
It's all about performance, isn't it, for guys? It's got to go one day longer, guys.
Where do they live, Yusuf? Where are they...
Stick insects?
Yeah.
All over the world. There's about 3,000 species of them. We don't have any native ones in the UK, but there are some populations around the country where pet ones have either escaped or been released and formed a little colony.
Is it true that their eyesight gets better over time?
I guess so, because like the snake, they shed their skin. And every time they shed, they get bigger. So I guess over time, their eyes develop more and more. But they're also nocturnal, so they can see quite well at night.
I mean, they'd need good eyesight to make sure they're not just shagging a tree, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Can you imagine 79 days in and you think, yeah, I've made a terrible This is... Wait till the lads hear about this.
Hey, you just keep that to yourself.
You'd keep shtum, wouldn't you? You really would.
Just quickly, there's some eggs there. So basically, the eggs even are camouflaged, so they look like seeds, which is a great way of dispersing them, because one problem that stick insects have, they obviously can't travel that far. And in terms of genetics, especially the parthenogenic ones, they want to spread those genetics as far as possible. So by making their eggs look like seeds, birds will come along and eat them. The bird will fly away, it'll poo it out somewhere far away, and the stick insect will hatch somewhere else.
That's amazing. Yusuf, thank you for bringing these queens of camouflage. Now, Karim, your spiders were fascinating, but please tell me you've got something a little less terrifying this time. Perhaps a gerbil or something, just low-key.
What I have here is a member of the blister beetle and oil beetle family, the Meloidae. It's a beetle, but it has an enormously fat abdomen.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that she has to be an egg-laying machine. The female can lay something like 3,000 eggs. I should also say that they're of interest because they're very rare. We've got about 10 species in that family in the UK, and all of them are rare. In fact, three of them are extinct in the UK. So they're really rare beetles.
It's weird to me that a female that lays that many eggs is an endangered species, essentially.
They have to have a solitary bee as part of their life cycle. So basically, the eggs hatch out to these little larvae called triungulins. I love the word triungulin. It sounds like a sort of race of aliens that live underneath the moon or something. Triungulins. The triungulins basically climb up a flower and they wait for the right species of solitary bee to come along to complete the life cycle. Now, the majority of times, the right species of solitary bee never comes along and they simply wait there, pining away and die. And that's why the female has to lay so many eggs. It's partly why they're also endangered, because in Britain, we've seen a dramatic decline in the number of solitary bee species. And this is linked into us losing 97% of our flower-rich grasslands since the 1930s. So we've got a decline in these beetles too, because the little triungulin hitchhikes onto the bee, accompanies it back to the nest, where it then feeds on the stores of pollen and sometimes the bee larvae itself, turns into this big grub thing and then completes its life cycle.
But obviously, they're the symbiotic relationships in nature. This one doesn't feel symbiotic. It feels
like...
The bee
one-sided.
Is basically a minicab driver who brings everyone back to their house and then watches as their children are eaten.
Yes, absolutely. But what's interesting is there are some species that have evolved a different strategy. There's a North American species where the triangulin larvae all actually, instead of dispersing, they all stay in a big lump on the plant and they secrete a pheromone that mimics the sex pheromone of the bee species. And so they actually are female mimics. And the male bee finds this irresistible. He tries to copulate with the ball of triangulins and then gets infected. They swarm all over his body.
I love that. But it's the sort of sexy version of, like, three kids on each other's shoulders in a trench coat trying to get into the cinema, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, we're one beautiful lady.
I'm definitely a bee.
And the males fall for it. But it doesn't end there, because, of course, it's not the male bees that build the nest and lay the eggs. So the triangulins have to get onto the female. So basically, it's like catching crabs. When the male mates with the female, these triangulins swarm off him and onto the female, except they're baby-eating crabs that she catches.
Whoa.
They are terrible.
I was like, oh, a solitary bee. Oh, I feel sorry. But then I feel sorry for the beetle that's rare. And then now I hate everybody in this story.
But I have to say, though, that they're not going to endanger the bees. I mean, their method of spreading is so random and so unlikely to yield success. They're not going to actually be a cause of decline of bees. And in fact, this relationship goes back a really long way. Recently, some Dominican amber from the time of the dinosaurs, the Cretaceous period, was found, and there was a solitary bee that had little triangulin larvae stuck to it. So we know that this relationship has been going on for a very long time.
That's not a relationship. Oil beetles aren't the only catfish in the animal world. They're a catfish, for a start. But plenty of other species engage in mimicry to mate. So let's play a game I loved when it was on TV in the 90s. Stars and Their Flies. Stars and Their Flies. I'm going to tell you about an animal that mimics another animal in order to mate. And you've got to tell me if it's true or I just made it up. And if you're lucky, at the end, I might do my impression of a generous host with points to spare. Karim, you're going to go first. Tonight, Matthew, the male lyrebird. It imitates a flock of mobbing birds to make the female lyrebird think a predator is nearby, so she better get mating pronto. True or false?
I think, given the complexity of calls that the lyrebird can mimic, I mean, that sounds like a sort of wonderful sort of thing that lyrebirds would do.
And you're absolutely right. The lyre is a big fat liar. They imitate noises they hear in their environment. Chainsaws, car alarms, both famously romantic sounds. So they could try Barry White in a family-sized bag of Revels, which always works for me. But you're absolutely right. Yusuf, the tiny male cuttlefish is pretending to be a female in order to avoid competition whilst finding a mate. True or false?
I reckon true.
It is true.
Is it?
Yeah. Larger giant cuttlefish attract mates more easily, and so they attack the smaller competition. So the weedier cuttlefish, the tiny cuttlefish, draw in their tentacles, change their colouring so they look female. They then get invited in to join the other females, whereupon they mate with them right under the more powerful male's noses. It's
quite clever.
That's the plot of many carry-on films,
yeah,
isn't
it? Right, Lucy, female lions have been known to pile up their dung to make it look like a larger male lion is in the area to frighten off unwanted attention.
We've all done it. Yeah. Do you know what? We've had two truths, but I'm going to say, yeah, it's true. They're clever lionesses.
Well, it's actually false, but several lionesses at a game reserve in Botswana have grown manes and been found to roar like male lions. Some people will do anything to get in the MGM film logo. It's not really like that. It's more like this. And unfortunately, that female bee that I'm pretty sure isn't a load of beetles is telling me that the end of Stars and Their Flies is upon us. Yusuf, thank you for bringing in these queens of camouflage. And that's all we've got time for today. I want to say a massive thank you to my wondrous guests, Lucy Porter, Yusuf Rafiq and Karim Vahed, and to the experts and staff here at ZSL London Zoo. I'm off to give the two-toed sloths a pedicure. Shouldn't take long. Thanks for listening. Goodbye. Nature Table was hosted by me, Sue Perkins, and featured Lucy Porter, Yusuf Rafiq and Karim Vahed. It was written by John Hunter, Catherine Brinkworth, Jenny LaVille and Nikki Roberts, with additional material by Kat Sadler. The researcher was Catherine Beasley. The music was by Ben Mirren. The producer was Simon Nichols. And this was a BBC Studios production.